From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, NATO warns Russia to pull back in Ukraine. Three elements for a comprehensive Iran nuclear agreement. The seizure of a Syrian town recalls a century-old Turkish-Armenian dispute. And foreign students adapt to rigors of the U.S. Naval Academy.
Leaving the comfort zone of your country to come here to a culture and language completely different from your own and adapt has been a challenge.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. NATO is again warning Russia against escalating tensions in Ukraine and along the Ukrainian-Russian border. VOA's Jeff Selden reports.
As a U.S. guided missile destroyer, the USS Donald Cook entered the Black Sea to reassure nervous allies, NATO Thursday released satellite images showing Russian forces sitting along the Ukrainian border. The pictures show artillery battalions, helicopters, fighter jets, and special forces. In all, 35,000 to 40,000 troops. Meeting with Czech officials in Prague, NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
If Russia is serious about a dialogue, the first step should be to pull back its troops.
Russia remains defiant. A state-run news agency quoting a Russian general as saying the NATO images are old, from last year. Russian President Vladimir Putin also denies Moscow's actions are part of any larger plan.
I just want to say that all decisions were made after it became clear what the mood of the people was. We didn't prepare for such developments.
Meanwhile, in parts of eastern Ukraine, pro-Moscow protesters called for more Russian intervention.
Russia will never leave us in trouble. I also want to call on Putin to help us, the southeast of Ukraine. Those who don't want help should go to the west.
In Kiev, Ukraine's acting president urged them to surrender.
There is no need to adopt a law on amnesty. We guarantee there will be no criminal prosecution of people who give up their weapons and leave the building.
But back in the east, a Ukrainian military convoy on the move ran into resistance from villagers, not happy to see a show of force. And despite Russian threats to cut off gas supplies to Ukraine, NATO and the U.S. aren't backing down either. On his way back from a trip to Asia, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel called his Ukrainian counterpart, assuring him the U.S. would continue to stand by Kiev. While U.S. F-16s took off during a pre-planned training exercise with Romanian forces. And back at the entrance to the Black Sea, a French warship sailed in to take part in military exercises. Another show of force aiming to bring calm to a troubled region. Jeff Selden, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Syrian rebels recently overran Kassab, a town near the Turkish border, inhabited by ethnic Armenians. That has drawn attention to Turkey's relationship with radical Islamic factions in the Syrian conflict and resurrected a century-old controversy. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Ankara has faced mounting international criticism since Islamist fighters overran the Syrian town of Kassab in late March. Many of Kassab's ethnic Armenian residents fled the town, charging that Ankara has supported the jihadists. Turkey denies the charges, but some observers say, whether they're true or not, it's paying a high price. All the more so, given that the attack on Kassab occurred on the eve of a key anniversary. Every April, Armenians commemorate what they say was a killing in 1915 of over 1 million of their people by Turkey's then Ottoman rulers. Armenians are stepping up their drive for international recognition of those killings as genocide ahead of next year's 100th anniversary. Members of the Armenian diaspora community are leading the criticism of Turkey over the attack on Kassab, charging that Turkey facilitated it or at least failed to use its influence to prevent it. Ankara strongly rejects the charge that what happened in 1915 amounts to genocide and disputes a number of deaths. But Sinan Ulgen, a visiting scholar at Carnegie Europe in Brussels, says the issue will not go away. He notes that a legislative proposal in France to make it illegal to deny the 1915 killing of Armenians was genocide while it was ultimately rejected by France's constitutional court, caused a major diplomatic uproar.
We see that constantly with the bill, which led to a big crisis between Turkey and France. It's just one example. And now we're coming to this 2015, the centennial of the 1915 events. And obviously Turkey will have to address that.
Armenian President Serzh Sargsyan has already compared the events in Kasab to those of 1915. Ankara is working to contain the damage, with state media broadcasting interviews with Armenians from Kasab who have taken refuge in Turkey. But Semih Idiz, a diplomatic columnist for the Turkish newspaper Taraf and Al Monitor website, says Ankara has blundered.
I think there was a miscalculation. I mean, bringing up the whole Armenian issue, of course, and it will also highlight the fact that Turkey is helping some of these extreme jihadi groups. So it's really a question of how the situation is going to be managed and what actually happens in Kasab itself. Now, if things get out of hand, this will reflect badly on Turkey.
Ankara denies it's supporting groups like the al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front, one of the militant Islamist factions in Syria. It also claims, as do the Syrian rebels in Kasab, that the town's ethnic identity is being respected. But with the Turkish government already facing growing criticism, both nationally and internationally, over its relations with the jihadist groups in Syria, observers say the events in Kasab will add to the pressure on Ankara to review its strategy towards Syria. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
Nuclear talks between Iran and world powers are set to resume in May. Diplomats have held three rounds of negotiations this year to reach a permanent deal by the end of July. It would build on an interim agreement reached last year in which Iran agreed to curb its most sensitive nuclear activity in exchange for limited sanctions relief. Robert Einhorn with the Brookings Institution has issued a paper outlining elements of a comprehensive agreement on Iran's nuclear program.
I think there are three main requirements for an agreement. One is to make sure there is very early detection of any Iranian attempt to violate the agreement and break out toward nuclear weapons. Second is to lengthen the so-called breakout timeline, period of time between when Iran might start such a breakout activity and the time it would have enough nuclear material for a single nuclear weapon. And third, to signal very clearly to Iran that there would be very strong consequences if it ever decided to violate an agreement and break out toward nuclear weapons.
You mentioned first the mechanisms for early detection. What kind of mechanisms could there be?
Well, you need very strong monitoring arrangements that would be conducted by the International Atomic Energy Agency. There are such arrangements in place with many countries, the strongest of which is the so-called IAEA Additional Protocol. But in my view, given Iran's very unfavorable track record on compliance, it will be important to go well beyond this additional protocol to ensure effective monitoring.
Do you think Iran would be willing to do that?
Well, they have, at the highest levels, indicated a willingness to accept greater transparency on their civil nuclear program. And if that's the case, hopefully they will be prepared to accept intrusive monitoring arrangements.
As you mentioned, you also feel there should be clearly defined consequences. What might those consequences be?
Well, I think that in the event of clear evidence that Iran has violated the agreement and is moving toward nuclear weapons, they should expect that there would be the imposition of very harsh sanctions and possibly the use of military force.
There's a lot of countries around the world not interested in getting involved in another war, including the United States.
Today, there's zero chance that military force would be used against Iran because negotiations are underway and they are promising. I am talking about a situation where an agreement had already been concluded, but sometime after that, Iran decided to pursue nuclear weapons and took steps in violation of the agreement to break out. It's in that situation where Iran was clearly heading toward nuclear weapons, that harsh action, including military force, would be contemplated.
Some people have said that they believe that Iran is using this drawn-out negotiating period to continue work on the nuclear weapons. Do you agree with that?
The interim agreement has been very effective at halting any further advance in key Iranian programs, especially its enrichment program and its construction of a nuclear reactor that could produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. So I think during this six-month period, Iran's program is really frozen.
Robert Einhorn, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. South African Olympic athlete Oscar Pistorius concluded a grueling week on the witness stand today at his murder trial. He is the star witness for the defense, and his testimony has been packed with emotion, tears, raised voices, and pitched arguments with a prosecutor who is determined to prove that he intended to kill his girlfriend when he shot four times through a locked bathroom door. VOA's Anita Powell was in the courtroom in Pretoria.
It has been an intense week at the Oscar Pistorius trial here in Pretoria. The South African athlete took to the witness box Monday as the defense launched its case in a trial that has drawn global interest. Pistorius delivered the anticipated drama within seconds of taking the stand.
I would like to take this opportunity to apologize to Mrs. Stienko. To Reva's family, to those of you who knew her earlier yet today, I'd like to apologize and say that there's not a moment, and there hasn't been a moment since this tragedy happened, that I haven't thought about your family. I can't imagine the pain and the sorrow and the emptiness that I've caused you and your family. I was simply trying to protect Reva. I can promise that when she went to bed that night, she felt loved.
Pistorius is charged with murdering his girlfriend, model Reva Steenkamp, at his Pretoria home last year. He says he mistook Steenkamp for an intruder and that he didn't think before firing four bullets through a locked bathroom door, killing her. But the prosecution argues that he meant to kill her and set up a blistering argument that attacked the athlete's story of that night and his claim that he constantly felt fear in crime-ridden South Africa. Head prosecutor Harry Nell, who has earned the nickname the Bulldog for his tenacious takedowns of witnesses, showed why when he began his cross-examination Wednesday. In a move that provoked intense criticism from trial viewers, Nell put up a photo of Steenkamp's gruesome head injury on courtroom screens.
That's it. Oh. Have a look there, mister. I know you don't want to because you don't want to take responsibility, but it's time that you look at it. Take responsibility for what you've done, Mr. Pistorius.
My lady, I've taken responsibility by me waiting and not wanting to live my life, but waiting for my time on this stand to tell my story for the respect of Reva and for myself. I've taken responsibility, but I will not look at a picture where I'm tormented by what I saw and felt that night. As I picked Reva up, my fingers touched her head. I remember. I don't have to look at a picture. I was there.
Nell accused the athlete of mixing up his lies. He also systematically and often sarcastically challenged Pistorius' character, painting him as an egocentric young man who is unwilling to take responsibility for his actions. Nell, a theatrical prosecutor, often leaned on his rostrum, his hand on his hip, his glasses twirling in his hand impatiently. On Friday, Nell, full of energy, continued to question a weary-looking Pistorius, who was broken down many times as he described the events of February 14, 2013. The trial has riveted South Africa, and it's the first major criminal trial to be broadcast live. Social media in South Africa has erupted with opinions on the trial, and the courtroom's public gallery is regularly packed. A South African broadcaster has even created a pop-up TV channel dedicated to the trial. Judge Thokozile Masipa this week made a rare comment to the public, prompted by laughter in the court during the cross-examination.
And I also want to say something to people out there. You possibly think this is entertainment. It is not. So please restrain yourselves.
The trial continues Monday. Defense lawyer Barry Rue has said he will call between 14 and 17 witnesses. Judge Masipa will ultimately decide Pistorius' fate, which could be life in prison.
But in this very courtroom, she is not his only judge. Reva Steenkamp's mother, June, has sat in court all week, staring stonily at the athlete throughout his emotional account of events. On Thursday, she told a British paper that he has left her unmoved. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
Food insecurity in Sudan could affect as many as 4 million people in the coming months. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization blames conflict, displacement, and poor harvests. VOA's Joe DeCapua has details.
The FAO says currently there are 3.3 million food insecure people in Sudan. That figure is expected to rise by 700,000 due to a lack of availability and access to food. Roseanne Markosich is the agency's representative in Sudan.
The numbers are quite astonishing.
She says Sudan is facing what she calls an early lean season.
When the harvest is finished and the amount of locally available food is diminished, that's what the lean season is.
Markosich says food support is needed for millions of households in Sudan. The reasons are many.
We have the issue of conflict. You see that in the Blue Nile, South Kordofan, and especially in Darfur right now. And you see huge displacements. There were about 380,000 people displaced just in 2013. And in the new year, up until the figures of April the 7th, we see an additional displacement of 280,000 people just in the Darfur region alone.
And livelihoods play a role as well.
Lack of economic opportunities for the people, which result in conflict, issue of natural resource management, conflict between farmers and agriculturalists and herders, for example. And then you also see drought and flood. So it's really a combination of human disaster and natural disaster, a combination of the two.
The lack of availability of food in many places in Sudan has caused food prices to jump.
You can see an increase in food prices at about 84% for meat, 45% for sugar, 40% for vegetables, and 70% for transport, which is very much linked to access and availability of the food.
The conflict in South Sudan only adds to the situation as refugees cross the border seeking safer haven.
It is very, very important that we continue to provide the people and the host communities and the returnees and also those people in IDP camps with seed so that they can plant. And many are leaving the camps and returning back to their homes, and they're returning to nothing. So these people need to have seeds and tools so that they can plant and have a harvest.
Besides thousands of metric tons of seed, the FAO official says nearly 1 million farming tools need to be distributed. What's more, Sudanese herders need help too.
We need to ensure that the herders' livestock is vaccinated, that they are receiving fodder to keep their animals healthy, because having livestock is not only a very important status symbol for the families, but it is a way of ensuring nutrition security as well as food security, because it is a source of protein and its byproducts, either through dairy or through eggs or through the meat that is consumed.
More than 11.5 million livestock would be vaccinated under the FAO plan. The UN agency says its interventions would cost $19 million. So far, donors have provided $7 million. So animal vaccinations and farming tool distribution are far short of the target numbers. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Manufacture of modern electronic components, such as computers and smartphones, requires rare minerals found in some of the world's worst conflict areas. Earlier this year, a major U.S. computer chip maker, Intel Corporation, announced that it has stopped buying minerals from the conflict zones and that its products are now conflict-free. VOA's George Putish reports.
Gold, tantalum, tin, and tungsten are often called conflict minerals because they come from the regions plagued by some of the world's worst violence. One of them is Democratic Republic of the Congo, where the commodity's high value is fueling fighting over the mineral-rich areas. Intel's conflict-free program manager, Caroline Duran, speaking via Skype, says it took several years to carefully build a new infrastructure to avoid inadvertently supporting the conflicts.
We know where those minerals show up in our products. We know which suppliers provide us parts or components that have those in them. So we actually spent the first couple of years, as I said, mapping the supply chain out to get to the smelter.
Duran says Intel required the smelters to show the sourcing of the minerals so the corporation could be sure that they were conflict-free. But simply switching to suppliers from other parts of the world could hurt non-combatants in conflict zones who depend on the jobs in the mines. In order to minimize the effects of the loss of those jobs, Intel is also helping other humanitarian efforts in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
We do support in-region programs, which helps provide a source of livelihood for those that are legitimate miners in the region. And we are investigating other opportunities to see from a broader corporate social responsibility if there's more that we can do in the region.
But other high-tech manufacturers continue to buy from conflict zones. Duran says she hopes Intel's initiative prompts them to reconsider their sources.
Our hope is that as we become more public on it and demonstrate that this can be done, that the others would do the same thing, that they would look through their supply chains and ensure that they know the source of origin for the minerals and materials they use too.
Although Intel has invested time and resources in this initiative, Duran says consumers will not see any increase in the prices of Intel's chips. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Throughout its long history, the U.S. Naval Academy has produced prominent leaders like former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and Senator John McCain. The Academy prepares young men and women to become officers in the U.S. Navy or Marine Corps. But not all of its undergraduate students, known as midshipmen, are American. Dozens are foreign exchange students who return home to serve their countries after graduating. Raymond Taylor has their story.
Attention on deck.
Back here, everyone, see?
David Ochi of Panama is one of about 60 foreign exchange students at the U.S. Naval Academy in historic Annapolis, Maryland.
Salir de una...
Leaving the comfort zone of your country to come here to a culture and language completely different from your own and adapt has been a challenge.
Santiago González Ayer is an exchange student from Spain.
It opens a cultural horizon so that one understands American culture better and is more involved in the culture.
The Naval Academy was founded in 1845 on the grounds of an old fort. The Academy says its mission is to prepare students to serve as officers in the U.S. Navy or Marine Corps. It strives to develop competence, character, and compassion in its midshipmen. International Program Director Tim Disher says the U.S. Navy benefits by also opening up the program to foreign students, especially in a world increasingly connected through technology and social media.
It used to be, when I graduated in 1981 from the Naval Academy, only the senior officers were the ones that had relationships with our foreign navies or our counterparts. That's not the case anymore. I mean, we're a smaller navy, and our students, even as midshipmen, have an ability to make an impact with our foreign partners. We are creating young ambassadors right off the bat, right after they get commissioned here.
He says the exchange also strengthens the education of U.S. midshipmen by enhancing their international exposure and understanding. Navy Lieutenant Paul Angelo graduated from the academy in 2006.
The world is becoming smaller and smaller. One day our students will be operating in the theaters or environments that that they've explored in the context of their interpersonal relationships here at the Naval Academy with the foreign cadets. And vice versa, it's important that our allies know exactly how we function and operate as a military.
After finishing the exchange program, González Ayer plans to return to Spain and become a naval officer. David Ochi wants to work as an ocean engineer back home.
I see my future in Panama.
The hope is they return home richer for the cultural experience they lived and shared with their fellow midshipmen at the academy. Reporting from Annapolis, Maryland, I'm Ramon Taylor for VOA News.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.